first inaugural, out of the gate, and hopefully not the last edition of the Planet Podcast.
Oh yeah!
It is party time right here.
It is excellent.
It is excellent. Woo 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 woo. I am Jay Marcus of the Podwits, and joining me on the very first, very special episode is the one, the only, very special himself, Dion Baia.
Thank you very much. Hello. Thank you for allowing me to guest on your beautiful new show. I'm very excited about it.
Oh, I'm excited to have you here with me, sir, and also excited to bring this format to the audience.
I'm very humbled. I cannot wait to listen to your expertise on this whole matter.
Oh well, you humble me, sir. So let's get real quick to the audience, because you guys are joining us for the first time here on the Planet Podcast, I hope. If it's just the two of us, that would be really embarrassing. I am, for lack of a better description, the Podwits Superman expert at large. This, by the way, does not mean that I'm the foremost Superman expert in the world. I wouldn't go that far, not nearly, and certainly there are many things I don't know. But because of this, I spent a lot of time on the Podwits podcast talking about Superman. So rather than monopolize the Podwits podcast with that, I thought I'd come over to this corner of the world and expound a bit about it here. But having said that, before you press stop or pause or skip or whatever,
Don't do it yet.
There's a caveat to all this. If you've heard me on the Podwits podcast, you'll know that I'm a big fan of the Richard Donner Superman films with Christopher Reeve as Superman, and that I'm kind of against the New 52, and I've got this very specific take on that.
There's nothing wrong with that.
There is nothing wrong with that, but I think I've hit that enough, that this is not going to be a platform or a soapbox for me on a monthly basis to come out and just talk about that. Mm. As a matter of fact, it really won't come up very often at all. Instead, Dion and I, and also Brian Zeno and I, and hopefully some other special guests, will be taking other tacks on the character of Superman. He's been around for over 76 years now.
It's incredible.
It's a hell of a run, and there's a lot of history there. And so Dion and I have elected to go through, for example, we're starting off with the run of the 1940s Max Fleischer Superman cartoons, which were groundbreaking and historic. When Brian joins me next month, we're going to start running on the history of Superman in comics and the various, you know, not just, you know, origin stories per se, although that's probably where we're going to start, but, you know, we're not going to hit it chronologically, but we're going to hit some of the high points and the lowlights of Superman, again, over the course of a 76-year history. There's a lot out there, so it's not just going to be John Byrne this, Richard Donner that, Christopher Reeve, hey, hooray. There's a lot out there, and so, you know.
Well, it's certainly a topic near and dear to your heart. I mean, you've been a fan of Superman probably since you were a boy, correct?
I'm still a boy, but for nearly four decades now, I have, he still sits at the top of my list. He is my favorite superhero, and, you know, he holds a very special place in my heart, always. And, you know, I do get a little miffed when people say, oh, he's a big blue boy scout, or, you know, he's hard to write for because he can twirl a planet on his finger. I have a lot of opinions on these things, but, you know, rather than dump them all out at once, I think I'm going to let it out a little bit at a time.
Good.
Dion.
Yes.
Before we get too far into this stuff, for those who may not be aware, for those who don't listen to the Podwits podcast, which, by the way, if you don't, I don't know how you spend your time, but you really need to get in on this stuff. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am Dion Baia. I do the Podwits podcast with you and Brian Zeno. I am happily married. I like, books. I like reading. I like watching movies. I don't know what I would call myself, a geekdom of whatever. I'm a basically, I guess, a I don't even know what
I'm. Do you listen to the Talking Rings? Is what we really want to know.
Yeah, I do. I do. Okay, I listen to. Yeah, I do that as well. And I do two of the podcasts as well. I do Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers with my friend Jay Blake. I also contribute with Brian Zeno on his Nick Fury cast, Wahoo, the Fury cast. So I dabble a little bit as well, and I try to lend support where I can. So I'm a jack of all trades, but master of none.
Oh, and we love you dearly.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's get started now on our journey with Superman. We've got we're talking the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons from the 1940s. I mean, this is very, very, very early in Superman-dom.
It's also very groundbreaking, I guess, in the field of animation as well. There's so much going on here that goes to influence things for probably to the end of the century.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they are the product of the Max Fleischer Studios, which, if you don't, for those who don't know, they were big. They had done Popeye cartoons. They had done the Betty Boop cartoons, I believe, yeah, as well. And at the time, the funniest bit about this is that I think it was Paramount wanted to do Superman cartoons. And so they were looking for an animation studio to do it. And so they went to Max Fleischer, and they said, we want you to do it. And Fleischer, he and his brother Dave, they didn't want to do it. So they said, okay, well, they quoted some astronomical budget. They said, yeah, we can do it, but it's going to cost us, I think it was $100,000 an episode.
Mm.
Thinking that, you know, Paramount was going to say, meh. Paramount said, okay, let's talk. And as a result, I think over time, the budget got reduced down to $50K per episode, but I think that was still astronomical for cartoons,
yeah,
at the time.
That's huge at the time for stuff like that going on with there, and like what you'd see Warner were getting for a period for those kind of shorts. So it's a good chunk of change to be working with.
Sure. And then from there, I think a legend was born. The Fleischers got together the voice talent from the radio show, Bud Collier and Joan Alexander, to play, you know, Superman, Clark Kent, and Lois respectively. And I think even the music, the theme, was carried over. I think, I don't. That's a chicken or the egg thing. I'm not sure, but I've heard it in both places. And as you pointed out, just groundbreaking effects. I think they were big. They did use rotoscope to a certain extent. Rotoscope is, of course, when you film actors on a sound stage and then you trace out, you know, their actions.
It definitely has a stylistic look, which lends itself almost to look like it's almost live action, because it's so true to motion, the movements that they're able to just trace over. And I find it weird that a lot of this, the Superman mythos, was begotten out of this series. I didn't know a lot of that. I thought it would have been in the comic books before, but they've kind of ironed out some of Superman's backstory here.
It's amazing how much of it. Specifically, there's one piece in particular which basically comes as a result of animation, and that is flying.
Yeah.
The ability to fly, because I think if you look at the cartoons, they did try every once in a while to have Superman leap, and it just looks stupid. And they knew that. They're like, it looks like a little bouncing bean. Can we just have him fly?
They do it the first couple episodes. You see them trying to do, or even in like the prologue, where you see him leaping, hens leap at the
building, yeah. Which is funny because that stayed as part of his, there was a faster than speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. Stayed with him through the 70s.
Yeah.
I want to say even possibly, a little bit in the 80s. And you just stop and go, he hasn't been leaping tall buildings in a single bound so much as flying over them since the 40s. So
yeah.
What the heck? And
I mean, I guess by that point, I always looked at it like it's just examples of his like agility, or what, he can run faster than the train. He can, stop a bullet. He can do this. And that was one of the things. He can leap so high, he can go over a building.
Sure.
You know,
but these are the things. And it's funny though, when you look back, you're right. So many of the seeds had been sown on the radio show, and then the big one, of course, being flying in the cartoons. But having said that, it's funny when you look at how they started when you see all the things that necessarily either weren't there or weren't important enough to mention.
Yeah.
Which will lead us to the very first episode entitled, alternately, Superman or the Mad Scientist, depending on... It has two titles.
Yeah.
So just to go through this real quick, it starts with the origin of Superman, walks you through it. From there, we get to the hustle and bustle of Metropolis, where a mad scientist has threatened to destroy the city, as he would, with his death ray. And so Lois convinces the editor of the newspaper to let her go investigate it herself, which she does. Of course, because it's a typical Superman story, she gets kidnapped. Was it the mad scientist then destroys a bridge?
Yeah, Clark shows his power.
And, yeah. Clark decides to turn into Superman and save the day, flies off there as the mad scientist then attacks what I believe is the newspaper.
Yeah.
Superman saves the newspaper building, destroys the ray, saves Lois, defeats the bad guy, brings him off to jail. And that's the story. And it's pretty cut and dry.
But it's each one of those sentences you could say we could talk about. It debuted on September the 26th, 1941 in the series. And it's interesting, like right at the beginning, his backstory, you know, it's different from what we know nowadays or growing up where, you know, I never looked at Superman's home is Krypton as being a evolved race of humans, as they say there, and you know they were bred to perfection. You know, I always looked at it like as they were aliens, but here it's almost like they're an evolved, more you know, simpler or idealistic sense of us.
Well, it's
so
funny
the connection there.
It's funny. You're absolutely right. I mean, we can go through this now bit by bit. In the origin, first of all, Krypton is name checked. So, but Krypton is the only thing that's name-checked in the entire origin. So you're right.
Green haze around it, much like the Stephen King-directed Maximum Overdrive.
You know, like right. It's got this nice little haze to it. And you're right. The description is, in the distant heavens, there once was a planet known as Krypton, whose mental and physical powers had grown to the absolute peak of human perfection.
Yeah, they're not so much like they're Martians. They're just like us. You know, they've been around longer. So
they're evolved.
Yeah, it's like us around the time of Star Trek.
And at the very least, if not over the course of many decades, this had sort of been borne out. I want to say it started to lose a little bit by the 50s when sci-fi became a little bit hipper. Then rather than being evolved humans, they just became futuristic humans.
Yeah.
With zero superpowers, but Brian and I are probably going to hit this next month when we start talking about the origins. But it was, I think, even in the 1940s, for the 10th anniversary of the character, they were talking about, you know, they retold the origin story, and you're sitting on Krypton, and the Kryptonians are looking down at humans because they don't have X-ray vision yet.
Mm.
So, which means, at least in 1948, that on Krypton, Kryptonians had superpowers, and maybe not all of the powers that Superman would have on Earth, but at least some of them.
Well, certainly almost godlike, you know, kind of, it's almost like, you know, the connotations of like Greek gods or whatever. They're very, you know, they came down to Earth.
Certainly. Which, again, was before people really sunk their teeth into Superman and tried to get him to be all Moses or Jesus or whatever the hell they wanted to say he was.
Yeah. Also, the next thing we hear is a passing motorist found him and brought him to a nearby orphanage.
Yes.
And that's completely different from how we know him now. And then they just explain away. And then as he got older and matured into an adult, then he was able to, you know, either discover or develop or hone these brilliant superpowers. And gosh darn, we're so glad and lucky that he landed in the continental U.S. as opposed to, like, say, late 30s Europe. Not late 30s. I guess it would have been the turn of the century Europe.
Sure. Well, here, let's take a moment. It's only, you know, a few seconds. Let's play the told origin story for the folks at home so they can hear just how bare bones this is.
In the endless reaches of the universe, there once existed a planet known as Krypton, a planet that burned like a green star in the distant heavens. There, civilization was far advanced and had brought forth a race of supermen whose mental and physical powers were developed to the absolute peak of human perfection. But there came a day when giant quakes threatened to destroy Krypton forever. One of the planet's leading scientists, sensing the approach of doom, placed his infant son in a small rocket ship and sent it hurtling in the direction of the Earth just as Krypton exploded. The rocket ship sped through star-studded space, landing safely on Earth with its precious burden, Krypton's sole survivor. A passing motorist found the uninjured child and took it to an orphanage. As the years went by and the child grew to maturity, he found himself possessed of amazing physical powers. Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. The infant of Krypton is now the Man of Steel, Superman. To best be in a position to use his amazing powers in a never-ending battle for true justice, Superman has assumed the skies of Clark Kent, mild-mannered reporter for a great metropolitan newspaper.
Okay, so as a matter of fact, the only shorter version of the origin I've ever heard was, I think it was Grant Morrison in All-Star Superman, who summed it up in like five phrases.
Yeah.
But yeah, a passing motorist found the uninjured child and took it to an orphanage. If you listen to that and you take that at face value, A, passing motorist, meaning it wasn't necessary, it didn't have to be the Kents, it could have been one person, took the child to an orphanage, and then the next line, as the years went by and the child grew to maturity, which means...
No Kent.
That as far as this is concerned, the kid maybe was never adopted.
Yeah, he grew up in the system.
Right.
And then, you know, he from, I guess back then, the system wasn't at least publicly looked upon as being like a bad place. Maybe like if you were inside of it or you had like, you know, a little later we see looking back. But at the time that was very idealistic. The government could take care of these kids because at the time there were tons of orphanages, either because of immigrants coming over here and dying or because at the time of the Depression or the 20s and the whole beginning of the century, you had a lot of these institutionalized places that would keep these kids, which have kind of been abandoned today. So for all we know, he could have went into the system, got to the age of 18, and said, holy crap, I'm a different kind of person than these kids.
Which is funny. I mean, like I said, I don't think it was the intention necessarily to say any of this, but I think this is how they had boiled down the origin. That these are the only things you really need to know.
But it wasn't an omission, though. I mean, is this true to say that at this time in the chronological order of Superman's history that we had not developed and had the Kents yet?
Well, no, we had the Kents.
We did have the Kents.
We absolutely had the Kents. The Kents, it took a while for the Kents to get actual names. Because for a long time, for a very long time, their names were in flux.
Mm.
At one point, they were John and Mary. At one point, they were Sarah and Eben. And then eventually, they landed on Jonathan and Martha. So at this point in time, from the point of the comic books, yeah, he had been adopted. But again, the only origin story told of Superman to this point, there were two versions. There was the one in Action Comics number one, which lasted literally one page. And then there was the version in Superman number one in 1939, which lasted literally two pages. So there was enough embellishment to know that he had been adopted, but there wasn't enough yet. But again, I guess... For time's sake, they literally chopped it down to what you needed to know, which was that when the rocket ship landed, well, what happened to him? He was found, he was taken to an orphanage. Does it matter that he was adopted? No, but you know that at that point he must have been cared for, and you can assume, maybe, that he was adopted. After all, you know, Clark Kent.
Now, do you see... We already know that there's a radio show going on, too, so people are able to get him in print and they can hear him over the air.
Right.
We're getting this now that these shorts are being put into features, so you can go to a movie house and when you see a picture, this is what you see before as part of the intro to the movie.
Sure.
Which,
by the way, to my mind, means that right now Superman is like the king of all media.
Yeah, I know, really. That means he's really in, and then, so he's in the print, he's in the at the time radio, and then he's in this, so yeah, he's all over the place. Now, does he, at the time, do you think the lack of, there's very little dialogue in these, as opposed to, say, the other cartoons at the time, which was kind of, I guess, simpler animation. Hmm. So I wonder if it was a choice because of budget, that they didn't want to try to animate, keep it as quiet as possible and tell the story through pictures as opposed to dialogue, or do you think it was a decision because of the budget? They didn't want to wrap themselves around having too much animated mouths moving.
Well, I think over time, I think these shorts developed in which there was more dialogue. I think for me, what you've got is Superman on radio is necessarily extremely talkative,
yeah,
because everything is about exposition, including up, up, and away.
Yeah.
You know, everything that comes out of the man's mouth is exposition.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in the comic books, you get a decent halfway point because he's still a little bit expository, but you have narration now to sort of help out. Superman had never been seen in motion. Like, you couldn't actually see something. Oh, look, who that is, that Superman. So I think, and again, this is merely supposition on my part, but if I were the Fleischers and I'm going to put Superman on film, Superman's an action hero. Superman, yeah, is the best action hero to date because he can, well, leap, and he's strong, and so you want to showcase that. You don't want to have him standing around talking. You know, that's a budgetary thing. That's like, you know, look, I can't afford to have an actor crash through a wall, so I'll have him talk about it instead.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? It's going to cost you the same to animate a cell, whether he's leaping through the air or walking across the screen.
Well, it's definitely not in any way, I think, needed or felt like you wish there was more. I think the style really does. It seems that they were like, hey, we have this really good blessing where we can basically do anything we want because it's an unlimited imagination with the palette of the pencil to the paper.
Well,
so
it's funny that you mention that because it's also this to me, as a consumer of superhero cartoons, this is incredible. Because it serves, you know, a lot of people look at it, and rightfully so, as a template for the Batman animated series and the Superman animated series.
Well, they name check it,
right,
in their history. They say that this
absolutely
was a huge influence.
But what they have in common, in addition, is that, to my mind, the Max Fleischer Superman cartoons were the last superhero cartoons that didn't have a narrator until Batman the Animated Series.
Oh, because you always had someone like a Ted Knight or somebody,
yeah,
there, like just saying.
Meanwhile,
like,
yeah, Superman goes streaking through the air. Will he get there? Like, you know, you just sit there and you go, okay, do I really need that?
Blue Falcon and Dog Wonder away.
Yeah. You know, you just sort of, you scratch your head. I mean, even into the 80s, it was a thing. And you go, you know, at what point, first of all, you know, a lot of the time, you know, kids' cartoons can do without narration. So can we just get a narrative that doesn't need to be, you know, explain to us?
Well, I guess they think that these are, I guess maybe like in another realm of saying the very simple, you know, morality tales, say, of, say, like the MGM cartoons or the Hanna-Barbera or the Warner Brothers, certainly, where these kind of shows, the Super Friends or any kind of like superhero show has to have some sort of, to get you from A to B of what's happening, as opposed to like, because it gets the ball rolling. So it's basically giving you like the thought balloon where you have Stan Lee coming in saying, hey, true believers, this again, catching you up to what's going on.
Well, also, let's look at these shorts for a moment. Let's actually just look at them. Forget about,
what? Yeah, but to put a point on that, I don't think it's needed here, so I don't even know if that was even discussed. I mean, at the time, they were like, we don't need to have any kind of, you know, narrator here. They have the guy at the beginning who says, who I forget his name. You said his name to me before, this podcast.
Yeah.
And then, right, you just get into it, and we don't need the narrator. So it's not like we're like, I wish we had someone telling us what's going on. We can perfectly see what's happening.
Well, it's indicative of a more adult form of storytelling. And I guess if you look at this, let's forget the story for a moment. Just turn the sound down. Look at it. It's an amazingly well drawn cartoon. I mean, you start out with, you know, Clark and Lois are called in to the editor's office to talk about, you know, to so we could read the ransom note for the city.
Well, even that,
there's this incredible use of light and shadow there.
Yeah, I mean, even that office there, setting it up, it is it really just gives you a kind of a little morsel of what you're in store for, because the animation is so gorgeous. You could tell because they have the budget. They can take the time to do these details, and it's very indicative of the time, where it looks like you're watching a color movie of the time. I mean, there's very great detail in what they're wearing. I mean, everybody's smoking. You know, like you're saying, the lighting is very...
There's a haze in the air.
It's very film noir. You could tell you're in a working office, like it's a paper office. So there's people up doing things, cutting things out, walking around, printing presses. So like, you know, you could tell that it's a proper, you know, man's office, that kind of a thing, you know. And when they're looking at this ransom demand, I guess as we start moving, it's funny that this mad scientist is not, he doesn't have a ransom. He's not really asking for anything. He's just saying, like, you're all going to pay.
Yeah.
So he's truly a maniac. He's not, like, saying, I want $100,000 by midnight. You know, he's just saying, like, you know, for what you've – they all laughed at me, and I'm going to show them, you know?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, which then – it's funny because you're right. It's so incredibly well said. It's a dark story. It's set up very well.
I mean, he's a lunatic.
And then we take a sidestep into what I deem to be a reasonable unreality for a few moments. You've got Lois Lane, intrepid reporter for the currently, I believe, could be the Daily Planet, though I don't recall if it's been name-checked yet in the episode.
No, and I guess we'll mention later on that the building is completely different.
Yeah.
It looks kind of more like an Empire State Building, and the building is changed and doesn't. We don't see the building again until it's the Daily Planet building.
But you got Lois Lane, knows how to fly a plane, and flies a plane to the mad scientist's lair.
And it's not even just like a slow moving kind of a plane. She's like flying a Spitfighter.
Yeah.
You know? And she kind of like, you know, I want to go, Chief. And Chief's like, well, and then she just runs off.
Well, that's indicative, I think, of the character of the time.
Yeah.
But, I'm going to go just grab any plane I can find and fly it in. And this is when...
And so, she must have some sort of lead to know where he is. So
he's the guy on the mountaintop with the giant laser beam pointed at the city. I mean, he's not really hard to find.
See, this is now to get into this guy a little bit. It's interesting how he's not really hiding out. So he's not like kind of like a Bond villain, as
right.
We would say, like you'd see years later, where like you know their hideouts in a mountain or under the ocean or something, a Labrador on an island. I mean, he's got like a Griffin observatory esque kind of a thing up very very. And I love about it carries through the entire series of these 17 episodes, the Art Deco design.
Oh, yeah. The design is beautiful.
It is so gorgeous. It is so realistic with the cars, and it kind of has, even though it takes place in the present time, it's much, I guess, like Batman the Animated Series does do this, where, and then it's kind of ahead in its time with the futuristicness of it, you know, with the little things going on with the technology or the like his death ray here, you know. So, and him himself, which I think I've talked to you before about it, I don't know if we agree, but I swear on rewatching this that he to me looks very Asian. He looks very, because at the time, the 30s, you had Fu Manchu was the uber villain that represented the mystique of the Orient and the Far East, and you had good people like Mr. Moto or Charlie Chan or Mr. Wong, but they were only like a answer to try to correct this. Persona we had since the beginning of the 20th century of that, you know, the Asians or the Japanese Chinese culture were lower than us, inferior. They were the evil because all they do is smoke, you know, hashish or whatever, and there are slaves. So then when we get up to the build of the Second World War here, you know, we also look at them now. We had the Snafu cartoons where they were very stylized and somewhat racist of their portrayal. So I see him as being like this Japanese or Chinese kind of a supervillain that's really going to destroy everything and not really care or have a ransom or any rhyme or reason of why he's doing it, except, like I said before, that he says in his ransom letter that he was laughed at some point.
See, given the Asian stereotypes that will eventually show up in these cartoons, I'm going to say I don't see it quite as much because, first of all, and I apologize in advance, but we're talking about stereotypes and animation. He's a bit tall. for, you know, to necessarily be that way. I think he has a very, you know, he has, you know, his eyes might belie that, but then again, you know, that could just be the, you know, token evil look at the time. It might be mildly reminiscent. I never got
well,
that
see,
impression.
I get him, it's like him kind of leaning towards the universal horror doctor, like the
he's a mad scientist. He's the you know, he's the stereotypical mad looking mad scientist.
You know, he could be, it's like him, Boris Karloff, with, like, you know how they used to do like Asian makeup, that kind of a thing. Yeah. The tall guy, or Bela Lugosi at the time, but he's certainly menacing. And, you know, you're right, as we get into the more the, if they're just drawing the Japanese or whatever, they do them very not in any well, you know, light at all.
What got me more, what was drawing my attention at this point, was the introduction of the bird sidekick.
Yeah, and this is the only episode that you see that in, and it's interesting because I guess they're still trying to carry over the audience, because, I mean, it's so serious.
Yeah.
It's almost geared to, like, adults on how they're just playing it completely straight, and the whole series does it except for this one bird. Yeah. And I guess it's trying to maybe bring the younger audience over, so you have that joking, because he's kind of like a Heckle and Jekyll kind of a bird.
He is, and, I mean, he's clearly got personality, and he's clearly understands what's going on, because he is clearly assisting the scientist.
And does he – oh, yeah, he is. But and does he at any point break the fourth wall and look at us and smile or whatever? Or
not so much that. But what does he do? You know, you got the, you know, so the scientist, who, by the way, just we're not being lazy here, he's never named, but no. You've got the scientist kidnaps Lois, and he's, you know, telling her about his evil plan, and, you know, he punctuates it with, you know, this is the greatest amount of devastation the world has ever known, and he punctuates it when he says it, and then he walks away, and the bird repunctuates exactly the way the scientist did.
Yeah, and I mean, even to the point where the bird's almost his accomplice, because when the bird sees Lois's plane, alerts him to it.
Yeah,
they go down to Lois. Just parks the plane outside.
Sure,
as you would. Yeah, they come in, they lock the door, and they're pulling the latches, and even the bird has a latch on his level to help.
The bird can pull the latch, and, you know, puts the door back when you know, after, because the scientist has clearly got a handful with Lois, so it's up to the bird to secure the stations. And I mean, even to the point where before that, again, the scientist is you know, starts up the machines to get ready to get ready to attack the city before Lois shows up, and the bird is laughing maniacally.
Yeah,
what's going on?
He's really enjoying it.
He's very, you know, he doesn't. He's the one of these things is not like the other component of this otherwise very almost adult cartoon, but, you know, the funny thing is, clearly, he was also something that composer Sammy Timberg was able to latch onto, because, first of all, aside from being able to create incredible action pieces throughout the, you know, the entire cartoon, you know, musically, he zeroed in and was able to, if you'll pardon the expression, I've heard it once before, he was able to Mickey Mouse with the bird, which is essentially Mickey Mousing is a term musically when the music literally, like, follows a character. Like, you can hear the footsteps, you can hear everything. It's like it's named after a very cartoonish style. And while the rest of the piece is grand and epic, the score, every time this bird is on, you know, you can hear the little pitter patter of the.
It's a little childish. Yeah. It's a little like, yeah.
But again, I think, as you pointed out, this is the one time that really happens. Other than that, as the series will progress, it decides, okay, we don't have to pander to kids. Just fine on its own.
I'm not completely into the bird, and I'm kind of glad to see him go, but I don't hold it against him for this episode. He's kind of in there, okay, he's doing his thing, he's there for the kids, but I do, I am kind of glad that he's kind of discarded, or not him necessarily, but this that element is discarded, and we just play it completely straight for the rest of the series. I'm sorry, no, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, I was going to switch gears, but it sounds like you were got to it first, so go ahead.
No, I was going to, just a fine point, we were talking about Lois. It's interesting that she's drawn a little differently than she is as the series progresses. They kind of give her bigger eyes. She's like almost like a Betty Boop kind of a look a little later on. I think here she kind of looks like a Katharine Hepburn, you know, more of the I wouldn't say femme fatale, but like the strong, independent 40s woman. I mean, that's completely evidenced by her just saying, "Chief, I'm going to take my plane and find, you know, track this lead down, and I don't care what happens to me when I get there because I'm not even going to think that far ahead." But I think she's perfectly fine here. I don't know why they did alter her. I mean, I guess they wanted to make it a little more. She is a woman. She is the female pinup girl,
well,
and he is the man. But I think she looks pretty cool here.
If I were to make a guess on that, if you look at this particular short, she's the only woman in the entire piece.
That's a good point.
But moving forward, I think you want to be able to make it very obvious to the audience who is Lois. You know, if you think about it, Superman is characteristic, obviously, based on what he's wearing. Clark Kent, he's the one with the glasses.
Yeah.
You know? And then you've got Lois, who could be one of any number of dark-haired women. So I think if you stylize her a bit more, she doesn't get lost in a sea of faces. But since we've made it to this part, we have to talk about the big action sequence that starts with Superman versus the Death Ray.
Well, right before we get to that, it's interesting to note. I have a question for you, and then I want to say one thing. Do you think now that he sends a ransom letter or to whoever? Now, do you think he's sending it directly to the newspaper, or do you think he's sending it to the police and the newspaper is getting a copy of it? Because later on, and I don't know if it's because Lois Lane has showed up to like meddle with him, he, after he attacks the bridge and blows the bridge up and kills who knows how many people, he a suspension bridge that's very like New York City or Golden Gate, but that wasn't even out there yet. Do you think he then attacks the Daily Planet or the newspaper because of he originally was sending them the note and then he's messing with them, or because Lois Lane is now, you know, throwing a cog in his wheel and he wants to just start screwing with her paper?
Maybe
I'm looking into this way too deeply.
Yeah, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say I don't believe that anybody involved with this cartoon actually bothered to give it quite that much thought.
I look at things way too deeply.
I think they had a certain level of. I mean, if you look back at the movie serials of the time, there was a lot in which, you know, ransom demands were given to the newspaper, or the newspaper was copied on the ransom demands that went to the police, because, you know, what kind of a criminal isn't going to want free publicity for his for his ransom demands? But honestly, I think it was literally done to further the story. Because if you stop and you look at these stories, these cartoons were no longer than 10 minutes apiece.
Yeah, we're
getting a lot of ground to cover in a very short period of time.
We're getting where we're going, because, like, again, he doesn't ask for anything in ransom, and then. His first thing he does is, I don't know if he's testing his weapon out or he's just starting to, he's going to like just one at a time destroy the city, because he blows up the bridge. And then I don't know if he's just like, hey, this is, look what I can do now, or if he's just going to systematically just go through and just melt every building, you know what I mean, in the entire city of Metropolis. So that kind of upsets Superman. And the thing I wanted to say is, we see Superman ducks into a stock room to change.
Yeah.
And that's something we haven't seen before, at least.
Well, we haven't seen anything before. There's no visual medium, you know,
so they
to
haven't
go
really
with
developed
here.
Yet the phone booth maneuver, which is interesting.
Well, I mean, again, I think that was a process of convenience. You know, it's you're in a building, phone booths usually are in the lobby, and so the idea of going all the way downstairs to change just to go up again seemed a little silly. So there's a stock room. And I think, honestly, that could have also come from the radio show, in that, you know, he needs a place to change. He needs to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So you find the nearest place, and a lot of this stuff sort of stuck.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. So I'm sorry. Now, you were going to change. So he changes into the Superman's outfit, and then you were going to change and talk about that his big fight with the Death Ray.
Yes. This is one of the greatest set pieces in the entire... And it's such a great example of the animation style and the amount of work that went into the animation of this piece.
Very iconic.
You know, starting from, you know, simple physics or a lack thereof, in that, you know, the ray hits the building starts to fall, Superman goes and literally just puts the building right back up, without it, you know, crumbling under its own weight. Evidently, they don't make buildings like they used to. But after that,
it's all steel. It's all steel and girders.
After that one little sort of movement, it's now Superman versus the Ray, and this is probably one of the greatest animation pieces of its time. As that Superman is lit entirely by the Ray. So, you know, the costume colors are shifted, the color of, you know, his face and everything is shifted, and there's very clear shadowing, you know, when he's facing away from it versus when he's facing into it, his eyes are squinting as he's flying through the Ray. It hits him, sends him toppling, you know, feet over head, over feet over head, backwards. You know, hits him back into the ground, then he goes up, flies again, finally demolishes the Ray. That sequence right there, forget about what's coming next, because what's coming next is even better than that. But that is an insane amount of animation there.
Well, it doesn't even seem like the Ray is really, not so much giving him a problem, but really can do anything fairly deadly. It's almost like an annoyance to him, where he goes up to fight, it hits him, it clearly throws him, knocks him down. And then at this point, he's like, okay, I'm upset, I'm pissed. And that's when he gets up and he starts socking it. And he just punches it out, and then even as the mad scientist near the end puts it on full power. And I love the Ray itself inside the planetarium or the observation area that is the mad scientist lair is very reminiscent of, again, the Universal horror movies with all the electronic gizmos and gadgets.
A lot of neon.
Yeah, and it's huge because the long shot at the beginning, there's just a little like control panel that he's at, and it's like four stories tall.
It's like a organ in a cathedral.
Yeah, it's absolutely huge. So when Superman's punching this Ray back and gets to literally the outskirts of the building, he grabs the tip of the Ray gun blaster and he bends it up, and you could see that the mad scientist put it at like a 10%, he's at 11 at this point, and you could see the Ray going, just getting clogged and going back and just. You know, first it's blowing like rivets off and things, just goes in and just destroys the whole machine and destroys the villain's whole lair. And it's like you said, it's an amazing piece of animation. Just him getting trapped in the power lines and coming out, and it's the whole thing is amazing.
Well, so once you get up top, he's engulfed in flame.
Yeah.
You know, which again, hard enough to animate at the time, but again. The color palette just jumps because you're going up the Ray. It's very much very mute blues and greens and I mean, we're talking navy-ish colors because it's nighttime and very muted. And then the moment he comes through, you know, you've got fiery reds and oranges and yellows, and then these mini explosions which dance light across him as he makes this grand entrance, and all of a sudden there's an explosion off to the side which almost hits him like lightning. You know, lights him up like lightning. And he flies through as this place is on fire, grabs Lois, grabs the scientist, the bird gets away, and they fly.
Yeah, it's pretty. And he takes the mad scientist as well. It's spectacular. And then you don't even know, is the machine powered by like a nuclear or atom kind of a power? It's just all
If it was, I think there'd be a lot more damage to.
Well, who knows? You know, at the time they didn't know. So it's like, you know,
I think electricity is what they were going with.
Yeah, you're right, because it's still that form.
And a lot, and steam. Power. I mean, the thing was pumping steam out, too.
Yeah, it's very Industrial Revolution, like almost, what do you call those, the steampunks now?
Yeah.
It's like that kind of a thing. But it's just the future noir of it is just so cool and very good. And like you said, the bird gets away. Everything is resolved. Then you have this last sequence where they're just sitting back in, like, it's Lois's office, and she's reading the papers. Like, well, you know, I did it, you know, I got away with it good, you know.
Well, it's funny because going back to, you want to talk about, you know, something that really couldn't have shown up anywhere else in this way, and it stuck. Mm. This kind of moment just stuck for the longest time, is that, you know, Clark congratulates her on the article, and she says, well, you know, I couldn't have done it without Superman. And as soon as she says that, Clark breaks the fourth wall, looks right at us, and gives us a wink.
Yeah, he gives the old wink. Like, and then, see, you know, isn't she an idiot?
You know, fade out. And
or so, play. You know, it can almost be also termed as like, women. You know, like, you know.
No. This was very serious. This was, we share a secret with Clark. Clark has that secret that he shares with us. If only she knew, wink, like we do. And for a cartoon, there was no reason to take that moment, but it was such a great moment, and it stuck with the series for a while. I mean, in the serials, it was kind of there, but not. But definitely, when we hit the Adventures of Superman television series, it was absolutely there from time to time. You know, where Clark would have he would occasionally wink at us, but yeah, sometimes he would just say something that's just end it so slyly, like, or Superman would, and it was so great. And I mean, that was for a cartoon. It's such a savvy thing, a savvy way to end. You know, you would never catch a Bugs Bunny cartoon or a Betty Boop cartoon ending that, or a Popeye cartoon ending that way. I mean, not that there's necessarily any reason to, but it was such an amazing thing.
And we should talk about this particular episode or short. I mean, how good it was. It was nominated for a Academy Award in the short subjects.
Yes.
You know, and that's huge for something at the time, you know.
It's so true. I mean, if you look nowadays, I think a lot of people would scoff at it and say, oh, look at it. But for its time, you could throw it up there against any full-length Disney cartoon or anything that Warner Brothers was putting out there, and you would have – you'd be hard-pressed to go, wow.
I mean, people younger than us do realize, I guess, that at the time all the cartoons and stuff were being made to put in theatrical films, so that's the reason why it's getting nominated, as opposed to, like, you know, there was no TV at the time,
right?
So it's like, you know, it was getting into the genre that could get it nominated if it was that good, and this clearly was. It was put up against a Disney Pluto short, and I guess called Lend a Paw, and that won in 1941, sadly. Which, I don't know, I've never seen the Pluto. I love myself some Disney, so I'm not disparaging Disney at all. And I love the early shorts of Disney around this era as well. But, I mean, this Fleischer series and this cartoon really,
I find it hard to believe that anything Pluto could do could match the sheer power of what was being shown in this cartoon. And again, I'm not saying Superman. I'm saying, look at the cartoon, and I would suggest anybody listening to this should go back, and you can find all these cartoons, for better or for worse, have entered the public domain, and so you can find them for free on YouTube to watch. I believe even Warner Brothers has posted them themselves.
Yeah.
Go back, just watch this one, okay? Forget about the rest. I mean, there are some great episodes out there, some clunkers too, but watch this one, and you tell me that it's not exciting, that it's not interesting, that it's not exceptionally well done.
Well, I mean, Disney was so good at what they were doing it at the time. And like I said, I don't want to take anything away from what was happening and how good the Pluto short could have been. But it just seems for the era of the 30s into the early 40s right here, you had a whole slew of companies, Warner Brothers included, doing those kind of cartoons. And for you to flip the script and do a very serious, groundbreaking, I mean, aside from some experimental animation, or maybe, you know, Snow White, you don't really see this kind of a style or this kind of a genre put into an animated form. So at the very least, this should have won on that merit, that, like you're saying, that this is just so ahead of its time, so new, different. It's opening up a whole different world or an avenue of storytelling that isn't, like, you know, geared to children and the very, very young, like the other slapstick ones are.
Yeah.
So it's sad that it didn't win, but I guess it's good that it was nominated. At least it's this series now is an Academy Award nominated series.
Yeah.
You know. So yeah. I mean, so what do you say about the entire episode? I loved it. I think this is great. This one was a great one out of the gate.
Oh, absolutely. I think it did everything that I think it needed to do as, say, a pilot episode where, you know, you want to rope in an audience. I think there's no better way. And quite frankly, I think that the audiences at the time, the kids, when they went to go see this thing, I think it probably would have floored most of them.
I would even be as bold to say that it still does nowadays. I mean, I remember seeing this growing up, and, you know, I don't have a memory of seeing this when I was very young, but probably when I was, like, say, 7, 8, 9, 10, I saw this. And it looks like it's brand new. I mean, that's how good it is. And it really just catches your eye, and you want to watch it. And like you're saying, if you walked into a theater to see, like, a Marx Brothers movie, and this came on before, after the newsreel, your jaw would drop to the floor. You're like, what the crap is this? And how am I going to see more of this? And especially since you already have it in comics, so you know who Superman is in the comic book form. There was a very popular radio show. I loved how they took Alexander and Collier and brought them over from the radio show and used the voices. So people, the kids are already like, oh my gosh, it's the same Superman we know and love. So it's just... especially since you can't digest this any other way. You didn't have a television at home to see this every day. So it's like, you know, seeing this in 1941 would have been just mind-blowing.
Sure, because you were going off of the radio show. Now you get to see the things that you're hearing about.
And it's like, wow, it's just like I imagined it. I imagined him doing all these kind of crazy stuff, and it's, you know, and it really looks like it's the real world and how they're animating it. It's unbelievable.
Also, before people jump down our throats, yes, let's not forget there is a comic book out there at the time if you want to see it, but that's, again, that's stills. And for an audience in the 40s to see in motion, you know, to see this stuff moving around, it's no longer does this have to be theater of the mind. This is, I can see it. And that's, I think, the most enticing factor of it.
Yeah, and it's done so well. I mean, it's just, it really looks like it could almost be live action. I mean, I know that lends itself to the rotoscoping, but also just how everything is, just the set design and the backgrounds, it's just, and the colors, it's so beautiful. And it just really, really just sets it a bar above everything else at the time. And like I said, it's so much so that even today, I think it still looks groundbreaking. And as we said, it's still influencing huge properties.
So let's step back for a moment and say, let's say you had to give it out of 10, 10 being best, 0 being the worst. What would you rate this one?
I'd probably rate it like an 8 or 9.
8 or 9?
Yeah.
I would definitely go with the 9. I think it fires on all cylinders. I think the only thing that detracts from it is the bird.
Yeah, but at least we see what they were doing with it.
No. Again, I think it's a misstep, but not... I mean, look, if I thought the bird was too distracting, it would have been a 6. But the bird is just one... That, and I guess, you know, the conceit that, boy, Lois has a plane on standby that she can just take whenever she wants. Which, by the way, you got to wonder if that plane got destroyed, because Superman carries Lois and the scientist to safety in the end. Which means the plane is still there, either destroyed in the explosion of the lab, or somebody's got to now go out there and pick it up. So, geez, I wonder if that's coming out of her paycheck.
I feel like it's one of those things where she's just like, you know, she's a modern dame, and she has, like, you know, she knows everybody, so maybe she has a boyfriend or, like, someone she's a hanger-on that works at an airfield and let her lend. The same guy who probably trained her how to fly.
Yeah.
You know, that was her ulterior motive. She uses the guy to get flying lessons and access to a plane. Not just any plane, like we said. It's like a Spitfire, like, proper, you know, military-issue plane. I mean, it looks like she can almost have, like, machine guns in the wings there, you know. So I bet you, you know, even if it did blow up, she's like, oh, I'm sorry, Jed. And he's like, oh, you did it to me again, Lois.
You know what? You go pick up the plane. We'll do dinner next week.
Exactly. And he's like, okay. Well, I know one of these days she's really gonna ask me out.
Well, some dame she is.
Yeah, I'll be able to put a ring on her finger.
So having said all that, it is time for this month's. Jeez, I got to find another way to say this. Planet Editorial.
Now, what's that, Jay?
The Planet Editorial is my parting thought on Superman for this episode.
Ooh, nice.
My opinions, and they don't necessarily have to be directly related to the story that we're talking about. It's just, you know, my thoughts as they are with regards to Superman. Agree, disagree. Whether you agree or disagree, write in. Let me know. I'd love to know what you think about this. My first editorial has to do with Superman versus Jesus.
Mm.
I got to tell you, nothing drives me nuts more than when people try to compare Superman to Jesus. It was not the intention. It sort of developed over time, and now even the writers and creators have started to embrace this and have tried to, you know, force feed it down us. I think, you know, it's too much, honestly. But I will say there is one spot where it's kind of true. I mean, and I mean universally, at least for me. It has nothing to do with the origin. I mean, the similarity is fine, but I don't dwell on that. Where I dwell on it is, I've got a character that I have been around now for almost four decades. And I have come to know in my heart who Superman is, what he would do, what he wouldn't do, and that may not always, you know, jive with what the creators are doing or what this person says or what that person says. But it's a very, you know, you can't put your finger on it directly, but you know when you hear it. You go, that is Superman. That's not Superman. And, you know, it's like, again, for religion, people who are truly religious, they know. You know, you hear people ask, what would Jesus do? Well, clearly, in order to answer that question, you got to know Jesus well enough to answer that question. You know, I know Jesus Christ. You know, like that's the take that comes about. I don't personally, but that's just me. But I do know Superman. And this isn't to say that I walk into a situation saying, what would Superman do? That's not it at all. But I know what's, you know, Superman would do in a situation, what he wouldn't. So when I see something like was it Superman versus the Elite, which was based on a great comic book story, in which Superman decides, but in this particular animated film, he decides in a fight to keep knocking his opponents into buildings and dragging them across buildings and so forth. That's not him. It doesn't feel like him because that's, you know, too callous.
Yeah.
And he cares a little too much to just put people in danger in a fight. He would try to move it to a remote location if he could. You know, if at all possible. And here he wasn't even trying. At least try. Get it out there somewhere. For example, you know, other things too. So I think this is how, you know, you come about your sense of what you like and what you don't like. You know, which Superman is yours? Which one is most embodies yours? And, I mean, I've got my favorites. We know that. But I think they also, I cherry pick. You know, I like this about this one, that about that one.
Yeah.
And I've put it into this amalgamation, you know, which is why, again, I can enjoy these cartoons. These cartoons aren't entirely indicative of the Superman that I love, but they're great cartoons, and they evoke the same sort of spirit. You know, so, okay, you don't see heat vision and, you know, other stuff, but it's Superman.
Yeah.
I'm cool with that. This is Superman. This is absolutely Superman. So, just my take on it. You know, you start to learn who a character is, and I think that informs how you feel about him over time.
Yeah. Agreed. I like that a lot, yeah.
Thank you.
I completely agree. So. Well, this was a very good first episode. Thank you so much for asking me to be the guest person in here with you.
Thank you for being a part of it, and thank you for helping me launch this ship.
No, this is great. Let's just keep the sails going and make sure there's no bad water coming up.
So we're going to have you back, next month, the month afterwards, where we're going to tackle the second episode of the in the Max Fleischer series called The Mechanical Monsters.
Ooh, I know. It's one very near and dear to my heart.
So, Dee, where, again, can everyone find you other than here?
I'm here every other month. I'm at Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, which could be found at saturdaysleepovers.podwitz.com, where me and another colleague look back at old movies that you traditionally watch growing up with friends at a sleepover on a night. I'm also with Brian Zeno, the third of the Podwitz, at his podcast about Nick Fury and the Halloween Commandos called Wahoo, the Nick Fury podcast, which could be found at furycast.podwitz.com. And you and I are both found at the Podwitz mother site at podwitz.com.
What is that?
The mother site podcast?
No, podwitz.com.
It's free.
Oh, it is free.
That's what it is. Yeah, we're on Twitter. Yeah. We're on Facebook. We're on iTunes. We're on Podroid. We're online. Everything.
We're on the line. You can find our line. We can find our podcast on the line. You can do a search on the line, and it's perfect. All right. Well, Dee, thank you again for joining us. We hope all of you will once again next month look up in the sky and join us for the Planet Podcast.
Yeah, Dr. J, it's been a pleasure. I hope people have enjoyed this and learned something and had a good old time and come back soon.
The march to victory! The flames of the Second World War burn across the globe. In the European theater of war, the Allied forces push back against the evil of Nazi Germany. And pushing our boys ahead at the front, no band of brothers fought harder and more ferociously than Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. Marvel Comics immortalized the courageous exploits of Sergeant Fury, Dum-Dum Dugan, Gabe Jones, and the rest of the elite fighting unit. Well, hell, heavens to Murgatroyd, here they come now, Sergeant Fury!
Look alive, you gold bricks! I'm not fighting the war by myself out here. What do you think we're gonna do when the Nazis actually show up? Come on, you boys, march!
Wahoo! The Sergeant Fury podcast will follow those gripping stories of combat and bravery from the beginning. Join Brian Zeno and Dion Baia every other Monday as they dig into Marvel's classic Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos issue by issue with humor and historical insight. Wahoo! The Sergeant Fury podcast is available on iTunes and at furycast.podwitz.com and is part of the Podwitz Podcast Network. Face front, soldier! Wahoo! Thank you.